Blog Talk Radio.
If you're on the East Coast, this is the Fun 100 Pound Radio Show, your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Robert Winfrey. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening in. Our special start time this evening of 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time is designed to avoid conflicting with the Super Bowl, because I have a family gathering that gets together for this every year, and much as I'm not the biggest fan of American football, and yes, I differentiate, it's a family tradition, and I'm not going to, I have to respect that. And there's free food, and it's all bad for you, which I love. So that's why we're starting early today. Thank you. It happens every now and then. Very rarely, but it does happen on occasion. All right. As always, even though we're going, at a different time, this is a call-in show, folks. We take live callers here. Tonight, we'll be talking predominantly about last night's UFC Fight Night 82, headlined by Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and Johnny Hendricks. Man, great main event. There was a rough couple of fights on the main card back-to-back, but we'll talk about that, too. Plus, we had two fight nights have announced. The next UFC on Fox got a main event and a location. It's in Tampa, Florida, so Mark Radledge gets to go to another one, I guess. And UFC 197 got a main and co-main event. The return of Jon Jones looking to reclaim his title from Daniel Cormier, and Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson fighting Henry Cejudo in the co-main event. Both great fights. Looking forward to those personally. So if any of that strikes your fancy, you want to talk about it, you have another opinion, thought, question, comment, etc., and you want to get it on the air, the number to do so is 323-657-0901. Once again, 323-657-0901. If you would like to call in using Skype, there is a Skype icon on the Blog Talk Radio player page. It's on the top of the player, off-center to the right. Click on it. There's three or four boxes of dialogue you have to click through. Once you do that, you'll show up in my switchboard. I'll get you on the air. If you call in using a phone, just know your area code. That's how I will identify you, because I don't have a producer to screen calls for me and, let me know stuff. It's just me and Jeff here. If you use Skype, you have my promise. I will not give out your full Skype ID because no one wants to be harassed. All right. With that out of the way, let me bring on my regular partner in crime, 411 Mania's resident jack of all trades, Jeff Harris, is here with us. How you doing, Jeff?
Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready for some football?
I mean,
we can
start.
I turn on my TV for some pigskin fun. I see a Super Bowl season. The biggest game each week is their specialty. I gotta get ready, make everything right, because Sunday Night Football's coming on tonight. Good morning, everybody.
Yeah.
Super Bowl Sunday, yeah.
It is. It's an infectious bit of energy, even for those of us who aren't, I don't religiously follow football, so. But even
do yourself, Winfrey.
Even me. All right, let's jump right into this main event. I don't know if I have necessarily the appropriate amount of superlatives. Stephen Thompson knocked out Johnny Hendricks in the first round. Just consider that for just a minute. the roster of competition that Johnny Hendricks has fought, 10 rounds with Robbie Lawler, 5 rounds with George St. Pierre, Carlos Condit, he fought Condit for just 3 rounds, but he has fought some seriously talented fighters. He had never been knocked down by strikes, much less knocked out before last night. It reminded me in some ways of what Holly Holm did to Ronda Rousey, in the sense that Johnny Hendricks is a very linear fighter. As a general rule, he has some, you know, circling, but generally he's going to follow you in a straight line and attack in a straight line. And that's just, you know, where he is with his development. A lot of wrestlers struggle to adapt with, you know, movement over large areas because wrestling is a very linear sport. It's about directing and redirecting energy, but it's all in a much more confined area. And a lot of your attacks at least start in a linear fashion. And Stephen Thompson just constantly outcircled him when Hendricks would overcommit and maybe get off balance or his hands were out of position. He'd get tagged with, you know, a good straight counter right or left, depending on his stance. Some good kicks. He finally just wobbled him with a couple of counter rights right on the jaw, finished and flurried against the fence and finished him. It was the best performance of Stephen Thompson's career against the best guy he's ever fought by a wide margin. Prior to this, the best guy he'd fought was either Matt Brown beginning his kind of resurgence or Jake Ellenberger. And neither of them is close to the level of Johnny Hendricks. And this didn't even look like it was close. I mean, it was bizarre. I know I picked Thompson actually by finish in my official prediction, so I felt, you know, pat myself on the back a little bit there. Then I remembered, no, you know. I was nervous about that prediction up until it actually happened. So I had to remind myself, no, you were not sure of this. You thought it might happen, but you're not as some, you know, genius prognostic. Deflate my own ego a little bit because I missed some other fights on this card. But man, Stephen Thompson, once he has kind of figured out how to move within the cage so he doesn't necessarily get his back pinned to the fence as easily, and there's a few things he did actually against the fence when Hendricks got him there that I want to talk a little bit about, but Jeff, man, this was a sublime display of movement, counter-striking from Stephen Thompson. I mean, what do you say other than give that guy a title shot because I want to watch him and Robbie Lawler fight?
Wonderboy! That kind of says it all, right?
Man.
Look, I mean, Stephen Thompson, I have to give my hats off to you, Robert, because you went all in on this prediction. And as the fight was getting closer, I think you grew even more confident that Stephen Thompson was capable of to pull off a win here. And I thought he was as well. And I think I made that clear last week. But I just picked Johnny Hendricks just sort of because he's the former champion. He's the guy with 5-round experience. And, I mean, if you looked at him this week, he looked like he was coming in and maybe possibly the best shape of his MMA career. And you couldn't tell that, you know, it looked like everything was dialed in for his training camp this time, just in terms of his nutrition and cutting weight. None of that was a problem for him this time, based on what we saw. And this is not to take anything away from Stephen Thompson's victory, Robert, but I feel like what we almost saw last night from Johnny Hendricks, it's like his game plan was titled Everything You Should Do Exactly to Lose to Stephen Thompson because, I mean, he did clinch with him and he did go for a takedown, and Thompson defended that takedown, his one big takedown attempt. He kept it standing where he wanted, but then what did Johnny Hendricks do? But he stood at distance. He stood at distance from Stephen Thompson. He stood in his kickboxing range. And he pretty much did exactly what you don't want to do against a world-class, you know, karateka like Stephen Thompson. and you let him kick your freaking head off. I don't know why he was doing that, but I think Matt Brown, if there's a blueprint to beat Stephen Thompson, I think we saw it with Matt Brown. Even though that fight was almost 4 years ago, you have to just keep moving forward, apply pressure, be aggressive. Don't let him keep distance. Don't let him fight you at distance. You have to stay close and make it dirty. Hendricks wasn't able to do that last night. He wasn't able to use his wrestling, and Stephen Thompson looked like a million bucks. Quite frankly, give him a title shot right now. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, just real briefly, what did against the fence what impressed me for two reasons. One, I mean, stopping Johnny Hendricks' takedown against the fence is not easy to do. I mean, he does a pretty good job of, you know, securing a single leg against the fence and being able to pull you away from it to get you down.
I mean, he does it to guys like Carlos Condit, to the likes of...
Got a takedown on GSP in that position as well, I think. Yeah, he got Robbie Lawler down from there.
Like, no one was taking down GSP when he was champion. He did it to Matt Brown. And so, for Stephen Thompson to be able to stop a takedown from a guy like Hendricks, a Division I NCAA championship wrestler, I mean, that's pretty, it says a lot about how much Thompson has been working on his skills these last few years since he debuted in the UFC, and just how much better he's gotten.
Yeah, what struck me, though, and someone else pointed this out, a lot of, even other, you know, strikers who have stalled him out against the fence, what a lot of strikers wind up doing in that position is you spread your legs out to get a wide base, lean back into the fence as your third point of balance so that you've got, you know, because 3 points of balance is actually the most stable as opposed to, you know, four or more. Three is, you know, really solid in that sense. But, I mean, guys like Anthony Pettis, when he gets up against the cage, he spreads his base so he can't be taken down, turns the hip a little bit, and he just waits there. And at that point, he's waiting for either the guy holding him there to make a mistake or get tired of that and back off, or the referee to separate them. Stephen Thompson took a much more proactive stance in that, you know, get off the cage, keep yourself at the appropriate angle, but he never conceded, okay, my back's against the fence, I'm going to stay here. He scrambled away from the fence as quickly as possible. And other people who know more about the specific techniques he used can, you know, talk you through that.
Did you see how he dropped that knee, too?
Yeah.
His balance is so impressive. The way he, when he was up against the fence with Hendricks, a place he does not want to be, and he's able to keep his balance enough where he's dropped to a knee when Hendricks is attempting that takedown, and he's able to climb back up to his feet. Because that's what Hendricks does. He usually grinds you out, and that's Hendricks' whole world. And some fighters, you can see them stop a takedown a couple times, but eventually, a wrestler like Hendricks is so relentless that he will keep at it until he gets you to the ground. And that's sort of what happened when Eddie Alvarez fought Pettis. Pettis actually was able to kind of defend the take. He was able to stave off the takedowns for a little while until the second half of the fight. Alvarez was just able to keep, you know, he was able to relentlessly pursued that takedown, and it eventually worked out for him, and he won the fight on points. So it was crucial for Thompson to keep this standing up and not let Hendricks take this into his world where he wanted to take it, because the problem is when we see strikers, and we see some really good strikers in the UFC sometimes, and they just have such a hard time dealing with the wrestlers. And, you know, they complain about getting taken down and getting grinded, but, I mean, if you're a striker, you have to be able to figure that out. And then,
rewatch how Stephen Thompson not only defends Johnny Hendricks' takedown attempt, mm-hmm. but the mentality and the urgency that he has of getting off of the fence. a lot of strikers are content to defend against the fence and just be held there. And Stephen Thompson wasn't at all. He knew that was the last place he wanted to be, other than, you know, under Johnny Hendricks.
But
and he reacted.
I could be wrong. Did it look like he dropped to his knee just to? I mean, I get the part about widening his base. Do you think that he was dropping to his knee to sort of dropping to one knee to sort of keep Hendricks in a way where he couldn't finish that takedown?
Some of it was that. Some of it was Hendricks was partially successful with that takedown. He got Stephen Thompson to a knee. Thompson also immediately used his, I think it was his left hand in that instance, to post up so he never gets flat, keeps his shoulder blades diagonal to the cage so that, again, with everything at that angle, he's not being controlled by the forward pressure. Even if you're defending a takedown, if a guy's squared up to you and pushing your back into the fence, you're being controlled there and your offense is muted. Thompson never conceded that position. Posted up there to keep from getting flat, dug an underhook, got back to, you know, the one leg that wasn't being controlled, dug the underhook, spun out of the clinch. Not only are those some of the most appropriate technical steps to get out of that position, that's the mentality and the urgency with which a talented striker needs to not get their back on the cage.
So other things I was seeing in my network last night was, you know, people were comparing Thompson to Machida. And I don't really quite see that because Machida had a karate style and he used karate in his fights. And Thompson does too. But the way Thompson utilizes karate is very different from Machida. And Machida, I think his flaw as a fighter is that Machida is always just a little too patient. And I think that's why Machida has lost some of those fights that he did by split decision that were really close, because I feel sometimes to his detriment, he's just a little too patient and he waits too long for his opponent to come in. And I think some of Machida's opponents were getting wise to that and they weren't too eager to, you know, zip in there so Machida could do his work. Machida is very technical, and there were some very impressive and great things about the way Machida fought. But, you know, when you're in a three-round fight and a judge is he's scoring the fight round by round, and you're just sort of waiting, and you're standing back, and you're waiting for your opponent to come in so you can score points, that's not always to your benefit fighting that way. Thompson mixes it up more and he throws his strikes. He has very dynamic strikes and he throws them more frequently than a guy like Machida did in his heyday.
Part of that is, and this is one of those things with, they're both karate fighters at their base, but there are many different styles and mindsets of karate. And, you know, so that affects how you implement them. Machida was very, like you said, he was very content to let his opponent make a mistake and then counter. Stephen Thompson, first of all, he has better front leg kicks than Machida does, at least in terms of what I've seen from actual fighting. I have no idea if
and
Machida
he uses that,
chooses
don't
not
use
to.
That kind of side, that, what do you call that? That side kind of karate stance?
Yeah, it's just a full-on side stance. A lot of boxers use it too. You present, because in striking, you present the least amount of area to be hit when you're completely sideways to somebody. They can only hit you in that side, or they have to throw round kicks.
Right. That stance itself, that can be a dangerous stance to adopt sometimes in an MMA fight. I mean, we've seen Eric Silva use that stance, and it hasn't worked out very well for him. But I just really like the way, because you don't really often see a karate specialist in MMA having as much success as Stephen Thompson does, but I feel like the way Thompson has adapted it and the way he's polished it, it's very impressive to watch. And, I was enthralled by that performance last night.
Yeah, the other big difference between him and Machida, again, Machida's very content to let you make that first mistake.
Right.
Thompson is not a forward motion aggressor necessarily, but he is constantly doing things, you know, be it lead leg side kicks, high kicks with his, again, with the lead leg that are not necessarily going to knock you out, but he's doing things that are applying pressure to you. He is forcing you to react. And then because you react badly under pressure, he's able to counter you more effectively. Again, as opposed to Machida, Machida lets you make a mistake. Thompson tries to make you make a mistake.
I feel like what Henrichs was, after Henrichs failed to secure that takedown, it almost looked like he was thinking too much about what he needed to do to readjust against Thompson. And while he was doing that, he had his chin straight out, and Thompson was just able to chip the hell away at him. And it was already the way Thompson was mixing it up. It was already doing a number on Henrichs' gas tank, and he was already slowing down right before the fight ended. I thought maybe it was going to get out of the first round before it got finished. So I saw that. And, you know, a lot of MMA fighters don't have great head movement, but that's just sort of the problem. His defense was low, his defense was weak, and his head was stationary, and his body was pretty much stationary too. And standing at a distance like that from a world-class striker like Thompson, it's just not good, man. It's just not good, Johnny boy.
Yeah, Thompson is one of those fighters who has, I think, kind of started to fundamentally understand how to move while fighting. And it's something that a lot of guys are starting to try to integrate into their game. When the lighter weight classes came along, it helped that that philosophy a lot, because you know everything there is technique, speed, angles. There's not a lot of guys who necessarily have the raw power to be technically inefficient like you do at, you know, heavyweight, light heavyweight, where you can compensate poor technique with just raw power. Guys like Dominic Cruz, Holly Holm, Demetrius Johnson, and now Stephen Thompson just have really kind of figured out how to integrate proper movement of not just proper footwork, but how to circle around the cage, how to let your opponent, you know, overcommit to something and then strike instead of just, you know, standing close, biting down your mouthpiece and swinging back. They've learned how to integrate, you know, some of these fundamentals from other high level striking. And yet you do have to tweak them in the MMA context, but once you figure it out, all the guys who are just linear fighters look like they're standing still. This great win for Thompson. I'm with you. Give him the title shot. I'm kind of salivating over the prospect of him and Robbie Lawler, because Thompson, there are two questions surrounding Stephen Thompson right now. Yeah. One is his conditioning. He's never fought five rounds. Now, I'm not saying – so he's not demonstrated poor conditioning in the past. It's simply not come up yet. So it's a question mark. The other – and this is a slightly – this is, again, another point that needs to be, you know, discussed – is his ability to take damage. Because he's not been hit very hard, very consistently. The only guy who was able to really kind of consistently take him down, or just, you know, even standing, just kind of beat him up, was Matt Brown. And Thompson, you know, he's improved a lot since then. Robbie Lawler has murderous power. And from a technical standpoint, Thompson is superior, but it's a question about how he, how does he wear damage? And
what happens if he's in like a war of attrition with Robbie Lawler? And
yeah,
he gets into those championship rounds with Robbie Lawler. And suddenly Robbie Lawler, and that's when Robbie Lawler, you know, that's when he wakes up. It's almost like Robbie Lawler, sometimes he's in a bit of a hibernative state in the first half of his fights. And then, you know, when you get to those fourth and fifth rounds, he suddenly opens up and And he makes the fight a lot tougher for you. So that's one thing. Robbie Lawler is not the same type of fight that Johnny Hendricks is. That being said, we've seen Robbie Lawler just kind of hang back and sort of wait in his fights a little bit and kind of be a slow starter. And against a guy like Thompson, that could allow for a guy like Thompson to score a lot of points and do and hit him a lot in the early goings of a fight.
Yeah, it's the fight I want to see most, I think, for the title next. Sorry, Tyron Woodley, you chose to sit out. He was offered a fight with Hector Lombard that he turned down.
Tyron Woodley, I feel like he doesn't want to do what a Stephen Thompson did. He doesn't want to go on a run and try to risk getting a winning streak. He wants to be strategic, and he wants to pick and choose his way to a title shot. And no matter what Dana White says, I feel like in the UFC, you can't really do that. Unless you're like, look, Conor McGregor still had to win five in a row in order to get a title shot. And even then, he still had to fight Chad Mendes before he got Jose Aldo. And Chad Mendes was arguably the worst matchup on paper for him. And Tyron Woodley, and I've heard, and this is just because I've heard a lot of his interviews, he's always trying, he doesn't want to go on a big winning streak. He wants to strategically pick the right matchup so he can be in a position to get slotted into a title shot. And I think when you're a fighter, even if you're as high level a fighter as Woodley is, and you're trying to basically be Joe Silva yourself, I don't think that's going to work out for you very well, especially when you fight the way Tyron Woodley does. And Woodley, oftentimes, he's just very hit and miss with his performances. Sometimes he lets his hands go and knocks you out. Other times he's just very flat. His performances are very flat, and you don't really enjoy watching him. And I think when you're a fighter like that, you're not in a good position to try to negotiate and slot your way into a title shot because you're not Conor McGregor. And Tyron Woodley, he needs to game it up a little more. And I feel like I read his Twitter last night, and deep down I know he knows he's getting passed over. Sorry, Tyron Woodley. Sorry about your damn look.
The other thing with Woodley, he's only on a two-fight winning streak. His last fight was over a year ago, and he beat Kelvin Gastelum by split decision. Since that fight, not only did we have, one of the craziest fights in welterweight title history between Lawler and Condit. That fight. We now just had that had people clamoring for a rematch because, I scored that fight for Condit, and I maintain that's the correct score. You now have Stephen Thompson, who just, on a impressive run.
He has the longest winning streak in the division. He just beat the number two guy, the former champion. And Woodley just doesn't have a signature win like that. He beat Condit. All right, I'll give it that. Give him that. He beat Condit, but since that fight, he lost to Rory McDonald. And he's always trying to sort of book his way into a title shot. It's just not happening.
It's not happening in a division that's competitive. It's not happening when other guys are having barn burner performances at a high level.
Welterweight right now, Robert.
Yeah.
Well, if lightweight is the most stacked division in the UFC and MMA, welterweight is probably the second most right now.
Yeah. I'd agree with that. Welterweight is, it was in a kind of rough spot. I felt
It was stagnant. It was stagnant.
It was stagnant for a while in towards the latter half of 14 after GSP retired, and it was just, oh, look, it's, you know, Robbie Lawler and Johnny Hendricks, and they're going to fight each other, you know, twice, and it was just, there was that period of time where a lot of the younger guys were still building. And, you know, divisions go through this. They go through, you know, ebbs and flows as guys come in and get better, and then those guys leave and, you know, other guys have to come up. It's just the natural progression of divisions. But it was in a spot that was a bit stagnant for a while. And now, you know, a year later, year, 18 months further down the road, we've got other prospects who are coming up, some other matchups that have emerged, and the division is in a very, very healthy spot for a while. I mean, we're not looking at guys who are peaking and then going to drop in the next year or so. We've got some guys who are going to be around for a while. So it's in a really healthy spot. I don't know what you do with Johnny Hendricks next. I'll tell you this, though. If I'm Tyron Woodley and I want a title shot, first of all, you can't sit out. You've got two guys ahead of you in terms of both fan support and recent wins in terms of, you know, both Condit and Thompson. I think you might try to redo Hendricks and Woodley. And if Woodley's able to win that fight, he's got a much better claim. I mean, sure, Hendricks may have lost this one. He's still a former champion. He's still highly respected, still has, you know, solid skill set. Couple that with a 3-fight winning streak, and, you know, we still have, and, you know, maybe Carlos Condit actually does retire. We're not sure. If Condit does, then Woodley, if he beats Hendricks, okay, gets the shot at the winner of, hypothetically, Thompson and Lawler. And, yeah, I think that's the fight you try to remake now, unless, you know, Hendricks isn't amenable or Woodley isn't amenable. Because those are, you know, they still beat, I think, the rest of the division. They're both very good fighters by and large. But that's kind of where I'd go with Hendricks. I'd try to put the Woodley fight back together since he seems to have his weight issues under control.
I'd be fine with that.
Did we need that main event?
I mean, Woodley wouldn't. He would try. I mean, he might. You know, he might just threaten to sit out and try to go to Bellator, which I wouldn't really mind either, to be honest with you.
I don't think Woodley has enough value to the UFC for them to necessarily stop him. And then we could get Woodley and Benson Henderson fighting at welterweight. Because I think Henderson's taking the 170 belt. I think he'd probably take the lightweight belt too if he wants to do that. I just think he's that much better than, generally speaking, the caliber of fighter that is in Bellator right now. All right, main event was awesome. Great performance from Stephen Thompson. Again, just absolute perfect.
Did I mention let's just give Stephen Thompson the title shot next?
I'm with you. Give him the title shot.
Keep mentioning it. Hope Joe Silva listens to this podcast.
There's some intern who works at Zuffa who listens to our show, because every now and then what we talk about gets.
Yeah, because I think Pettis versus Nate Diaz just got booked, didn't it?
I don't know for sure.
Well, I think they're talking about that fight, and I think that's the fight we were asking for, as I recall.
We asked for Donald Cerrone and Jim Miller before they booked it, and we got
it.
So every now and then. So, yeah, to the unpaid intern at Zuffa, Thompson should get the next title shot. That's our concerted opinion. Man, we needed that main event to deliver, because there was the two fights that preceded it were one of them. I have a little bit of understanding about how it turned out that way. Not the heavyweight fight between Roy Nelson and Jared Rochelt was awful. Roy Nelson wins via unanimous decision, 230-27 and a 29-28. I gave Rochelt the first round. I felt he was more effective, and all Nelson did was kind of stalk forward. These two missed a staggering percentage of their blows. I mean, it's one thing when a guy like Dominic Cruz or Stephen Thompson makes you miss. You know, they bait you into overcommitting to your strikes, and they're out of the way with movement, you know, upper body or footwork, and then they counter. It's another thing when you just miss. And these two guys just missed a lot. Rochal never made a concerted, consistent effort to get a takedown. He only had one attempt that got anywhere. That was in the third round. He actually got a hold of a single leg, and Roy Nelson still defended. But yeah, Nelson wins rounds 2 and 3. This fight was the worst. This is the worst fight of the year so far. I don't remember if I'd have to go back and look over some of the other fights I've seen this year to remember if any others potentially challenged for that spot, but this was just the worst. This was just the worst.
It's not that I dislike Roy Nelson. What I dislike about him is the way he fights in his rudimentary striking style, which, you know, sometimes, you know, leopards just can't change their spots and all that, but I feel like a guy as experienced as him should, I don't know, try, I mean, I don't know, where does Roy Nelson even train? Who does he train with? Because I just don't get...
Oh, he's got, I think he does,
way,
I think he does his own thing, he's got his own gym.
For me to watch.
I think he's one of those guys who has his own gym.
I mean, and he wonders why he's not able to break through to that upper echelon. Because I feel like I've talked about it before ad nauseum on this show, that you see these guys, they stalk forward, they have the center of the cage, they're stalking their opponent, they have him up against the fence, and they don't either don't throw, they don't engage, or they can't finish those exchanges, they can't cut off their opponent. And Roy, I don't know, maybe Roy was sort of, maybe he was weary of the takedowns or something, but it just annoys me so much when you see a fighter stalking forward and his opponent is up against the fence, he's really not throwing any type of strikes, and you just don't see him engage or throw anything at all. I hate that. And Roy has a powerful overhand right, he has a sneaky uppercut, but it seems other than that, he doesn't have any kind of straight punches. The angles he throws, I mean, it looks like some of those punches he throws, he looks like two kids, like on a playground in a fist fight. Did you see that at all?
Both of these guys, that's an apt description.
It's like, I think having good dynamic angles is good, but it's also sometimes good to just have straight punches. And Roy Nelson just doesn't throw straight punches. Overeind doesn't really throw straight punches either, for that matter. But Nelson throws just some of the most awkward, just weirdest punches ever, and he has heavy hands. So I feel like if a guy like Nelson could actually work on his boxing somehow, I feel he could be a much more formidable striker. But it doesn't look like he works on that at all. He just kind of does what he wants, and he's not really... I feel like with Nelson, he's never really trained hard enough with good sparring and training partners to really improve his game. And I feel like it's been that way with him for the last 5 years. Am I wrong here?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I think that's a rather apt description. Roy Nelson has just made his choice
Jared
about...
Jared Rochal is a wrestler. Is a wrestler. He's always going to be a wrestler. We can't get away from that fact. But I feel like Nelson, you know, who has heavy hands, who has, you know, a grappling background, is a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, I feel like he could become a more well-rounded fighter, but he doesn't.
Jared Rochal, an impressive wrestler. He is, if memory serves, the winningest heavyweight wrestler in Oklahoma State University history. That's nothing to sneeze at. I think he's the one who finally broke Jack Briscoe's record. But he's struggled to adapt his MMA game to be a truly kind of well-rounded fighter. I think Rochal should consider a change of camp. I'm not sure if, you know, He's with Team Takedown, I think, and Mark Layman is the head coach there. I'm not sure that that group is the right group to improve his overall game. So, and again, if I'm Rosenthal, I consider it a terrible fight. Just terrible fight. The next fight was also bad, but for a slightly different reason. Ovince St. Preux defeated Rafael Feijão Cavalcante via unanimous decision, 230-27 and a 29-28. I think I had this 30-27 for St. Preux. I'm a little more forgiving of St. Preux in this fight because he rolled his ankle on a kick in the first round. That's not only is that kind of painful, it hobbles your movement, it hampers what you're able to do, and it's difficult to adjust to on the fly. And he threw a leg kick that landed with the foot. It landed at kind of an awkward angle, and it just, you know, jacked up his ankle a little bit. So I'm a little bit more forgiving of the fact that he couldn't fight the way he planned to and normally does due to in-cage injury. I'm not happy with the fight either way, but I understand he had to make adjustments.
Pretty, but Ovince St. Preux, I mean, he dominated the fight. He got the win. He almost finished Cavalcante there at the end. He just ran out of time. It was just awkward because he wasn't able to get into a position to really stop him earlier, despite how it was sort of one of those awkward fights. But St. Preux dominated him. He dominated him and he won. So you can move. This is a good. I mean, this is a good win for him. And Cavalcante should probably get cut. Let him go to Bellator, World Series of Fighting, or whatever.
Cavalcante just desperately wants to get away from USADA's testing.
1-4 in his last five. I think, you know, I feel like he's 12-7 fighter. I feel like he got his opportunities to become something in the UFC. It's just not happening.
Well, the other thing to remember about that 1-4 in his last five, that's 1-4 since he failed a drug test for steroids in Strikeforce.
No, he did knock out Igor Pokerjack.
No, so, no, that's the one win in those last five. That happened after he got his only win. His only win since failing that drug test for steroids is that.
One and four in his last five. Before that, he had the submission over Mike Kyle, and that got overturned.
Yeah, I don't like to accuse fighters or, you know, be blindly accusative or, you know, give into kind of the mob mentality and witch hunting that goes on around steroids and, you know, PEDs and drug testing and whatnot, because I think there's a lot of guilt, of presumptive guilt before all the facts are known. I think there's a lot of guys trying to eyeball it without looking at real data. I'm going to go ahead and say at this point in time, in the case of Feijão, he benefited tremendously from, even if it was just that one fight, he benefited from from using some form of illegal performance, and now that he's been forced to not utilize those, he started to slip. I mean, his level of competition also jumped up, so there is that as well, but
now, I'm not going to specifically point fingers, but other people are saying since USADA came in, we're seeing a lot of guys underperform and not look as strong and fast as they used to be.
That's true. And, you know, to be fair, some of it might not be roid related. There's a lot of guys
could
who
be the weight.
Some of it could be the weight. The other thing is, a lot of fighters might be done taking supplements because I know this has happened in the past where a fighter has tested positive for a PED that they weren't intentionally taking, but it was part of a supplement mix, supplement
but
they were taking.
Even if they,
now, that,
even
now
if
that's still their fault.
Intentional, it was ignorance and
yeah.
I feel like we know enough about what's going on where obviously you should figure it out.
Yeah, and
it,
I think it's just to the point where those guys are now saying it's not worth the risk to, you know, take some of these supplements I was taking before. And there's just a, you know, there's just a process going on right now of guys, you know, some of the, I have no doubt, some of them are, have stopped utilizing, you know, various performance enhancing drugs. There were guys failing tests before, and now they've stopped, and there's going to be a bit of a drop off.
I mean,
I acknowledge that. Yeah.
Josh Barnett.
And I also imagine there are some guys who are simply altering how they deal with their bodies to avoid, I mean, even if they're not taking anything, they're making changes to what they take, that, you know,
right,
stuff that's legal,
I mean,
that might
apparently
they
have some very, they've incorporated some new human growth hormone tests, and that's something that wasn't getting tested 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I think some of the enhanced commission tests would test for GH, but now I think USADA is doing that very regularly. So I think that was probably one of just those loophole things that guys were probably getting away with. And so, yeah, look, I'm not saying a guy like Hendricks was on stuff, was on the sauce, and that's, you know, why he just hasn't looked as great lately, but there could be any multitude of reasons, but it does, I mean, it does seem to be quite coincidental. So
yeah, it's an odd thing. Cavalcante looked like crap in this fight, as he has through most of his UFC run. Appreciate OSP, you know, adjusting his game, gutting through the injury. And again, if you've ever rolled your ankle, I mean, it's not fun. You know, it's not necessarily fight-ending in the sense that, you know, you, if that gets injured, you're done. Fight has to be stopped for your own safety.
And,
but, you know, it's not fun. And he was in a fight, and he kind of gutted it out. So, you know, props for that.
He's very good. He's very talented and athletic. And I think he'll be a perennial top 10 guy for quite a while. He might even hit, like, you know, the lower end of the top 5. But he just has too many holes in his game, I think, to really become a contender. But I think he'll be sort of at this sort of perennial top 10 level for quite a while.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. All right. Now, those two fights back-to-back, that heavyweight and light heavyweight fight, were kind of rough. They absolutely murdered the momentum of this card. The fight before that, next up, a flyweight fight between Joseph Benavidez and Zach Makovsky. Benavidez wins via unanimous decision, 30-27 and 229-28. I think I gave this to Benavidez 30-27. The round that people gave Makovsky was the second. I didn't, because I don't think his takedowns.
I think
no,
I
he
was
never
leaning more toward giving him the first, but even then I thought it was like I wasn't committing to giving him the first even.
Makovsky did have some good scrambles in the second. He was able to kind of get the back as the round ended. He had a couple of elevated takedowns. I mean, he never secured position, but I mean, if you value that effort, then I can see where you're coming from. I'll say that Zach Makovsky looked a little better this fight than his last couple. His striking is still a major liability. That's where the biggest work is to be done. He needs to get confident in the way he strikes, either moving forwards or backwards. He's way, in this fight at least, he was way too content to try and counter Benavidez.
He always fights like that, though.
Yeah, that's a mentality that he has to change. And I'm speaking specifically of his skills, because he actually was punching back at Benavidez, and that's something that he hasn't done a whole lot of in some of his other fights. His confidence in his striking has not been there. It looked like that's an area he's been improving on. Fundamentally, still, if he can't take you down and control you, he's not going to beat you. And you know, taking down and controlling Joseph Benavidez is,
and that's
as far as
why
I can tell, impossible.
He's making these decisions when he fights the top 5 guys. You know, he came in, he fought pretty well for a while, and now he's just sort of leveled off. He's not getting better, and I don't know, maybe he's just not very comfortable fighting at flyweight. I'm not sure. But he's a very flat fighter, and he doesn't mix up his offense enough. He's never quite aggressive enough. And to me, that's not how you want to fight a guy like Benavidez. But, oh, well. I mean, or John Dodson, for that matter. A very tentative John Dodson, by the way. So
yeah.
I really just – I know he's in there with Joseph Benavidez, and Benavidez is one of the top talents of the lower weight classes. But I feel like Makovsky is better than what he's constantly showing us. He's just not showing up.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think this was the first time he trained at TriStar for this for a fight. So, and again, I have issues with some of Firas Sahabi's stuff, but he's a very technically sound trainer. And if technique is what you're trying to work on, you could do a lot worse than Firas Sahabi. Benavidez might be next for a title shot. He's won five in a row.
He could technically face the winner of Cejudo versus Johnson, since that fight.
Well, especially
just got
if it's Cejudo,
because he has won. He has won five in a row now.
Well, yeah, especially if Cejudo wins. And I'm not picking Cejudo, but that's the guy can fight. So let's not discount him.
Look, styles make fights. No one is unbeatable in this sport, not even Demetrius Johnson. That simple.
Yeah, very true. So if Cejudo wins and wins in dominant fashion and no one wants to see an immediate rematch, Benavidez gets the next shot. Even if Mighty Mouse wins, and again, right now in the dark preliminary pick, I'm going with Johnson because I don't think anyone at flyweight beats him. But even if it is Johnson, you know, Benavidez has won five in a row. And he's just going to get to a point where you have to give him that title shot. I still, even based on what I saw in this fight, I did not see Benavidez doing anything differently to make me think he would beat Demetrius Johnson. But there comes a time when, you know, if he goes on this prolonged winning streak, it's just like, you got to give it to him, even if he loses. And, I mean, if he loses 3 to Mighty Mouse, you know, he's got to go back up to bantamweight at that point, which would not be the worst thing. He's a very competitive bantamweight.
I would say when he moved down, he was still one of the top 5 bantamweights in the world.
Easily. If he goes back up, he's fringe top 5, just by virtue of what he's done at bantamweight before. I mean, I'm not sure if I pick him over Cruz or Dillashaw. Fight with Barao would be interesting, but I think Benavidez would beat Faber. You know, I think most of that division he can beat. And a fight between him and Dillashaw, or another fight between him and Cruz, you know, he's the only guy who's come close to beating Dominic Cruz. I think his title fight with Cruz was much more closely contested than the Dillashaw and Cruz fight. But that's, you know, just my perspective there. You know, another win for Benavidez. Not a bad fight. You know, there were some really fun scrambles in that fight. At light heavyweight, ooh, this was nasty. Misha Serkunov defeated Alex Nicholson via submission in the second round with basically a neck crank. If you haven't seen this, Serkunov got a rear naked choke position, in the sense that his arm was around the face and the jaw of Nicholson. Now, Nicholson kind of kept his chin tucked to prevent the arm from getting under his chin and around his neck. One of the things you do. A lot of guys might start fighting in that position to get the arm actually under the chin against the neck for the choke. A lot of guys do. Michael McDonald did against his last one against Kanahara. He kind of fought that battle of, you know, wiggling the arm around to get it under the chin. Misha Serkunov does not care if his arm is around your neck or around your jaw. He went gable grip, palm to palm, twisted it into a neck crank, and squeezed so hard he broke Nicholson's jaw. You can, if you didn't see this, you can actually hear his jaw crack right before he taps out. I got to cross off, you know, hear another man's jaw break off the old bucket list that for the, because of this fight. Guys, if you've got a grip and a squeeze, you do not need to necessarily be under the chin. You can go around the jaw and, I mean, I know that it's not a choke at that point, and there seems to be this kind of culture of, you know, oh, no, it wasn't under the chin, it wasn't a choke, why'd he tap out? Well, because if you've got someone on you with a squeeze around your jaw, that is, that can be excruciating, and it can be damaging to the structure. This broke his jaw. His jaw's going to need surgery. I mean, that's how badly he broke it. It was, I mean, the squeeze on that, the physical strength, it's amazing. But just be aware, guys. There are people out there with enough of a squeeze that even if they're around the jaw instead of under the neck, they can either apply enough pressure to get it to compress backwards anyway, or just threaten to break bone. Man, that was, again, broken jaw from a squeeze, man. Misha Serkunov is one of the few guys who could be considered a legitimate prospect at light heavyweight right now, and that division's very anemic, but man, beastly, beastly strength in that choke. Jeff, I mean, was that the first time you've heard a man's jaw, you know, break live?
I mean, this is a combat sport, man, and look what Mark Hunt did to Stefan Struve. His jaw was split right, like right down the, you know, the mandible into two parts. And I don't know if I've heard it quite like that, but guys can get their jaws broke.
Yeah, I just meant have you heard it before? Because I've seen other guys.
I've
seen it happen to other guys.
Because I think the last time that there was the instance with Struve, which was a punch, and then I think Clay Guida did it to Dos Anjos in 2010, and we didn't hear that either. So
Tony Ferguson broke Aaron. Tony Ferguson broke Aaron Riley. The other one off the top of my head, Tony Ferguson broke Aaron Riley's jaw with an uppercut.
I don't think we've heard, like, I think we might have heard, like, a bone snap before, but I don't know. We've probably heard stuff snap before, haven't we?
Tim Sylvia's arm, I think. There was a bit of a pop.
Right. It's not always audible when something like that happens, But the good news is Nicholson got engaged at the weigh-in, so he's got that going for him at least.
Man. Yeah, that's true. You know, sincerely good for him as far as that goes. Hope the jaw isn't – I mean, I know it's going to need surgery to fix, but I hope it's not – you know, it's strange to say. I hope it's not bad.
At least he put a ring on it. He put a ring on it at least, so she's got to stay with him now.
He's got
to nurse him back to health now.
All right. And kicking everything off on the main card, Mike Pyle defeated Sean Spencer via TKO in the third round. Just kind of a barrage, elbows and knees against the fence. This was a good fight. They went back and forth a little bit. Both guys had knockdowns. Very competitive fight. Mike Pyle just has kind of the veteran instinct of knowing how to fight in close quarters, utilizing knees and elbows appropriately. And that's something that a lot of young guys don't have. It's something that kind of comes with in-cage experience. And just, you know, after he rocked him in the third round, he got him against the fence and just kept unloading until the ref stopped it. Might have been a bit of a late stoppage here. It could have been stopped earlier for sure, without too much controversy. Good win for Mike Pyle. Broke the first two-fight losing streak of his career. You know, just really good, kind of fun, back-and-forth, mid-level, welterweight fight. I have no complaints about this.
Pyle was the better MMA fighter last night. Spencer had the better boxing. He had good counter-striking, but Pyle was the one mixing it up. He was using his elbows. He was using his knees. He used his grappling. And that was a complete MMA performance. But, man, I love it when a guy can offensively use elbows like that. He used a spinning back elbow that was like a John Jones move. And then he was just unloading, like, fun elbows against Spencer, up against the fence. I love it when a guy – an elbow is a very effective weapon in an MMA fight. And more fighters, if you can throw that – if you can, you know, strategically throw those elbows, man, those are a game changer.
Yeah. Elbows are a really effective tool in any fight. Whether or not they're legal is another issue, but they're effective.
They're legal in MMA. And
they are.
A fighter who knows how to use his elbows, those – I mean – John Jones knows how to use elbows because he, you know, John Jones is not a very heavy striker. His punches are not, he's not a heavy-handed puncher. But those strategic pinpoint elbows he can mix up, you know, his striking game with, they make a huge difference. And I love it when a guy can use those offensively because they are a legal tool. And I... You know, use what you can use. I mean,
yeah.
If you can elbow someone on the ground and cut them open, go for it, man. If you can cut a guy open and you can win on a cut, why not? It's not illegal. That's a legal technique. Use what you're allowed to use.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Now, I completely agree. For a long time, elbows being incorporated into striking was an underutilized aspect of MMA. And I agree with you about John Jones. I mean, I'm sure getting punched by him doesn't feel good, but he seems to strike even harder with his elbows than he does with his fists.
Jones has just never been a heavy puncher, and he just never has been. He just doesn't have – he's not a heavy-handed
punching power. You've got, it's one of those things that there's so much about it that is just, like, genetic. You either have it or you don't. You can accentuate power with technique, but you can't grow
it. Right. But he's so good everywhere else, and no one, very few people in this sport throw elbows the way John Jones does, and very few
he
guys.
He uses them almost like other guys use punches. It's crazy.
Man, props to Mike Pyle. You know, using his old man mullet power, you know, he's still fairly competitive, and I always enjoy watching him fight. So I was glad to see him pick up a win.
Yeah, doing it for the 40-year-olds out there.
Yeah.
All right, that was the main card. On the prelims, Josh Berkman won his lightweight debut, defeating KJ Noons via unanimous decision, 330-27s. I don't know what was up with KJ Noons here, guys. I don't think he threw a strike the entire first round. Berkman just kind of picked him apart from the outside with leg kicks, body kicks, you know, mixed it up with some, you know, he did a lot of body work in the first round. There were a couple of fun exchanges in the second, but just KJ Noons did almost nothing the entire fight. Very odd performance from Noons. Berkman, you know, good lightweight debut. He seemed to have a bit of a hard time with the weight cut. He said he had to drop a lot of weight over the last 24 hours before the weigh-in, something like 18 pounds. So hopefully next time around he's got a better handle on the weight cut, but, you know, good for him getting a win. Derek Lewis defeated Damian Grabowski via TKO in the first round. It was a heavyweight fight. At least it was over quickly. I will say this, Lewis improved his takedown defense a fair amount. Grabowski tried a single leg, I think. And Lewis was able to not only get his hips back the appropriate way, but also adjust his angle, use underhooks to kind of get Grabowski off of him. Even a year ago, in that same position, I think Lewis would have been taken down. So good for him working on his game. It was heavyweights. He got a win quickly. I'm not going to complain. I was very wrong about this fight. At flyweight, Justin Scoggins defeated Ray Borg via unanimous decision, 2 30-27s and a 30-26. The second round could have been a 10-8 for Scoggins. Borg just never got a handle on the distance. The reach, the distance, the movement of Scoggins. Really good performance from Justin Scoggins. He trains, I don't know if he's in the same gym that Stephen Thompson is, but they're both from South Carolina, and they both have karate and kickboxing backgrounds. So I imagine there might be some overlap between them. They have some similarities in how they fight and how they move. So good win for Scoggins, man. I picked Borg. I've got a lot of respect for both these guys. The fact that Scoggins was unranked kind of shocked me. I know he had a rough stretch, a couple of fights against really talented guys, but those are really talented guys. And I mean, John Moraga and Dustin Ortiz are very, very good. I had Scoggins ranked, I think, over either Chris Carriasa, who just retired, or Sergio Pettis, who has like one win at flyweight. I mean, just Scoggins was deeply underappreciated going into this fight. Put on a great performance against a guy I thought he was going to lose to. This fight went pretty much the exact opposite of how I thought it would. So, again, look kind of like a genius for picking Stephen Thompson to actually finish Hendricks. Then you hear, hey, you were completely wrong on this one. Yep. Still working on it. My ego is not inflated at the moment. I completely ass backwards on that one, guys. At featherweight, Diego Rivas defeated Noad Lahat via knockout, flying knee in the second round. Lahat took Rivas down in the first round, utterly dominated him on the mat. Lahat's a very talented grappler. Second round, Rivas baited him into kind of ducking and reaching for a takedown, launched a flying knee, landed flush. Lahat was out. Went very similarly to, I think, Lahat and his other loss via flying knee in the UFC to Hani Jason. I think it went kind of the same way. Lahat got a takedown, kind of controlled that fight, and then once they were back on the feet, flying knee. So if you're going to fight Noad Lahat, practice your flying knees. That seems to be his weakness. Brutal knockout. Brutal. On Fight Pass, Mickey Gall defeated Mike Jackson via submission, rear naked choke, 45 seconds into the first round. I've seen a fair amount of low-level MMA. Fights between guys who are less than three fights into their professional careers look either like this or there's a lot of stalling on the cage. This was Mike Jackson's professional MMA debut, Mickey Gall's second fight. If you ever see fights between guys at this levels of this stage of their careers, this is kind of what they all look like. Gall landed a right hand, got the back, choked him out. Now he will fight Phil CM Punk Brooks at some point later this year, theoretically, assuming no one gets injured or fails a drug test. I don't care about that fight at all, but I care about CM Punk in an MMA context as much as I care about every other guy making their professional debut, which is not a lot. And kicking everything off, Alex White defeated Artem Lobov via unanimous decision, 330-27s. Lobov is not UFC material. He just is one-dimensional, not even very good at that dimension. Alex White picked him apart. moving backwards, utilizing takedowns, just great counters from White. Lobov walks forward with his hands down, wings wild hooks. Anyone who's halfway decent should be able to beat that. I'd give Lobov his walking papers. He just doesn't have what it takes at this point to be in the UFC. Good one for Alex White, who had a couple of tough outings his last couple of fights, but there's some upside to him. All right, Jeff, those were our prelims. What do you got? What burning desires do you have from that group of fights?
That was a sick flying knee by Diego Rivas. Besides that, Scoggins versus Borg was a really fun flyweight fight, which I was expecting, but an outstanding performance by Justin Scoggins. I think maybe the best he's ever looked so far in his UFC career. I like Derek Lewis. I don't think he's ever going to be like a great fighter, but I enjoy watching his fights for the most part. Berkman, you're not going to get top 10 fights. Sorry, but I mean, good on you. going down the lightweight and picking up a win over the likes of KJ Nunes. But
you're not going to get a top 10 fight at lightweight. But on the plus side, between 11 and about 20 are all just about as good as the guys in the top 10. So
based on what you've told me, Robert Winfrey, he can't cut weight like that in California either. Everyone, guys, CM Punk is not a lottery ticket. If it is, it's the cheapest lottery ticket on the freaking planet.
Well, winning a lottery ticket in the sense that he's 2-0 as a professional and he's going to fight on the main card, most likely, of a UFC event for his third fight.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's not going to get $1 million because of that. He's going to get whatever he's still probably getting the league minimum, so he'll get 10 and 10. I'm sorry, that's not a lottery ticket, all right? It's not.
Well,
Artem Lobov,
I agree with you in the sense that it's not instantly winning the lottery. Mickey Gall has put himself in a position to be somebody very early in his career, and there's a lot of guys out there fighting and struggling along who would kill for that spot.
For that attention, yeah, but I mean, can he capitalize on that? I'm skeptical. I am skeptical if he will actually capitalize on it. So, but to me, there's a difference between it being that and calling it a lottery ticket. So,
I think the golden ticket analogy of, you know, you've got a chance to go see Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory is more analogous, which is kind of what's a lot of the – I think both Cruz and Bisbing use that analogy on the desk.
Yeah, that makes
lottery
more
winning is.
Okay. And Artem Lobov needs to be out of the UFC now. You gave him his opportunities. He's not UFC caliber. Them's the breaks. Them's the facts.
All right. That was UFC Fight Night 82. Thank you to everyone for stopping by and commenting. A couple of you guys, I know Lenny the Troll and Larry Zonka, playing along with Mark Radulich and his airplane quote on whenever I do coverage. World's Longest Man. Boy, that feels weird saying.
Look, in the MMA zone, we may not get as much comments as wrestling or movies, TV sometimes, but I feel like we do get – I feel like qualitatively we get very good comments for the most part.
Yeah, again, you guys – I know Chael Sonnen's Coke dealer. These are names that people have chosen for their Discus accounts. I don't actually know if Chael Sonnen does Coke, much less his dealer. Who commented on the final report. I know Justice Bringer tends to hang around in the MMA zone. There's somebody else whose screen name I can never recall. But, you know, you guys,
J-Ball.
For your ability to show up, talk, interact as adult, answer questions that someone else might have in an intelligent and Billy the Pilgrim, who got a laugh out of me when he mentioned how I recapped the Nelson and Rochalt fight. Thanks to you guys for helping, you know, craft a group of guys who can, whenever I read the comments you guys make or get the chance between fights to potentially comment myself, you seem like you're just a bunch of friends who got together and are talking, you know, about the fights that are going on. And that's a really, we have one of the healthiest, you know, comment sections for, you know, anywhere, you know, for all the, for MMA zones that, you know, kind of provide live blogging coverage and whatnot. You guys have worked, you know, very hard. You can disagree without becoming children and just hurling insults. I thank you guys for that. I really do. Because I've seen other, you know, bigger websites that get more traffic and some of the comment exchanges on those sites. And I take you guys over. If it's a choice between having you guys and, you know, a lower comment total, but having polite, intelligent, you know, discussions between you guys or 10,000 trolls, I'll take you guys all day, every day, twice on Sunday.
Hey.
So thank you guys again. I do appreciate that. All right. There is no show next week. Right. No, there's no event next week. We will have a show next week, though.
We'll be previewing Fight Night 83, right?
Yes, because that is on the 21st, which is a Sunday.
That main event just got shuffled.
Cowboy and Cowboy. Who is the one true cowboy of the UFC? So, yeah, we'll be back on the 14th to preview the card.
Donald Cerrone is the true cowboy, to answer that question.
Yeah, we'll be back next week to preview that. We will be off the 21st because I will be covering that event, and then we'll be back on the 28th. Just to really quickly give you guys a heads up about what's coming up. A couple of fights that got made. Again, John Jones and Daniel Cormier for UFC 197. That'll be a good one. I've listened to some other people talk about this fight, and I'm starting to think Jones is
John
Jones
I think
is scary.
He's gonna win. And I think most people are going to pick Jones. I'm not saying, you know, again, styles make fights and anything can happen in a fight, but I feel like safe money's on Jones.
Yeah, the co-main event, Demetrius Johnson and Henry Cejudo for the flyweight belt. Demetrius Johnson going for his eighth successful title defense. Man's on the verge of history. Again, right now, preliminary pick. I don't think anyone at flyweight beats Demetrius Johnson. But Henry Cejudo has a legitimate skill set and the right mentality. Because, I mean, he was a big long shot the Olympic Games when he won the gold. He was a numerical underdog the whole way. So he's not used to fighting. He's used to fighting from behind. Also, the next UFC on Fox card got announced. It will be in Tampa, Florida. Again, Mark Radulich gets one that's within driving distance. I'm jealous. Main event is Khabib Nurmagomedov returning to fight Tony Ferguson.
I love that fight. Love it.
Loved it the
That's
first time. Love it this time.
Eliminator, man.
You know, here's the crazy thing, guys. I have nothing but respect for Nurmagomedov's abilities.
I'm picking Tony Ferguson. I'm picking El Kakoui. I don't care.
I'm with you. I mean, a 2-year layoff against a guy as surging and improving as Ferguson is, I won't
it's
be shocked if
Nurmagomedov. It's a very interesting fight. And Khabib has ways he can win, but
yeah.
Ferguson is just so gritty, man. And five rounds makes it, that's the main event, right?
Yeah.
So five rounds makes it very interesting to me. And I like that Khabib, he's coming back, and I like that he's getting this fight. I love this fight. Awesome.
Yeah, it's, again, if these two had been both active and they were meeting, I'd go with Khabib. And if he wins, I'm not surprised at all. I think Khabib's going to be lightweight champion. And bear in mind, I am aware of what a claim that is. But after that layoff against Ferguson, right now, and again, I've reserved the right to change my mind before we actually have to make picks. But right now, I'm actually leaning towards
Ferguson.
Okay. All right.
So it's not official, but I believe Pettis, Nate Diaz, that's in the works for Jones versus Cormier. So that will likely be on the undercard on April 22nd. This is from Bleacher Report's Jeremy Botter, who basically broke McGregor versus Dos Anjos at Now it's UFC 196, but it previously UFC 197.
That'll be an interesting fight. Because if Diaz can bait Pettis into fighting stupidly, then Diaz can win that. All right. The only other kind of thing that came out over the last week was for, again, 2 weeks from tonight, on the 21st, the Fight Night 83 card. It was going to be Donald Cerrone and Tim Means. Tim Means failed a preliminary drug test. Guys, I have to mention this. It doesn't necessarily mean he was taking anything. Preliminary failures can be false positives. There are still procedures to go through. Apparently, Yoel Romero's B sample came back negative.
That's still not even official yet.
I know. That's what's kind of being... But my point is...
That's what Malky Kawa is hinting at, but even Malky Kawa, his manager, won't even say that.
Yeah. So, again, my point here is, when they announce that they're taking a deeper look and someone has been provisionally suspended, that just means there's an irregularity, potentially a failure. We need to go a little bit more in depth. It's not a big flashing red light that says, nope, cheater. And I think a lot of us treat it as such.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, I just have to ask that wait for the full reports to come out. Wait for the more in-depth testing to be done. They fail again. Fine. At that point,
well,
it's
look,
confirmed.
Well, Robert, realistically, that's not going to happen because...
I know. I'm just asking for a little bit. You know, again, let's just consider the whole process here, guys.
Talking about the internet and the court of public opinion. It's just not how things work. I mean, I kind of agree with the sentiment, but... I always just generally assume the worst about these guys anyway. I mean, and I feel like I have good reason for doing that. And I just think, we do have to wait for all the, you know, all the information. But I think maybe, I'm starting to wonder, maybe USADA shouldn't even wait until the preliminaries. Or, I don't know. But then we'd have the issue of, if Tim Means fails, he's fighting in a main event, and is that ethical?
Yeah.
So I kind of see that, but
this instance, my personal opinion is that they need to be more clear about the procedures in place. You know, when they say someone's been provisionally suspended, make it clear that this is not necessarily an outright drug test failure, or they have tested positive for X, Y, and Z. Just, you know, help educate your fan base instead of keeping them in the dark and sensationalizing some of this stuff. That's
right.
My big gripe.
Well,
that main event is now. Sorry,
I would agree with that. That's it.
Yeah, the new main event for that card is now Donald Cerrone and Alex Oliveira. We have two cowboys fighting because I think Lenny the Troll mentioned that, you know, there's so many pit bulls. Have pit bulls. Guys with the nickname of Pitbull or some variation in MMA, and there's a lot of them. A lot. Have they ever fought? And I'm not sure. I off the top of my head, I can't remember any. Numerically speaking, it has to have happened. Maybe on smaller shows. But I really hope they do put the cowboy nickname on the line for this fight. It's still at welterweight. So, still a good fight. Still a really good fight. Two guys who fight similar styles. Ought to be a lot of fun. All right. That is going to wrap us up this evening, or this afternoon. Thank you all for being here. If you're listening live at our special time, thanks. I really do appreciate it. After the fact, thank you for listening. Again, still really appreciate it. Jeff, you saw some movies.
Deadpool. I was trying to sing the Deadpool rap there from Team Headkick. So if you have time, go on to YouTube, look up Deadpool rap by Team Headkick. It's in the film. I don't know how you feel about Deadpool as a character, Robert, but I did see Deadpool.
I don't like him.
Well, I enjoyed the movie, Robert, and okay. I would recommend you go see it anyway. So go
I've
see
Deadpool.
I've got
to see it because I'm reviewing it.
Well, I am also reviewing it for 411. That review is in there, and I want you all to check out that review this week and enjoy that review. Besides that, I will also be reviewing Zoolander 2.
Oh,
honestly, like I like Zoolander, but to me, Zoolander is not even a great film. So I just don't even get why the maybe the sequel will be entertaining, but I don't even get why it's getting made, quite frankly. Because as I recall, the first Zoolander wasn't even that successful. But whatever.
My hatred for the films of Ben Stiller could power a third world country if you could convert it into anime.
I disagree with that because I love Tropic Thunder. I love that film.
I am more than willing to say that anyone who enjoys Ben Stiller's work, good for you. I don't mean that condescendingly. Humor is very subjective. If you enjoy it, by all means, keep doing so.
I think Tropic Thunder is awesome, but Zoolander, I feel like, is not even his best work. So, I don't know. Waiting, like, 15 years to do a sequel, I mean, I don't know. I just don't get it, but it's happening. So, there you go. So, there's that. I already turned in my MMA column for this week. It will be Stephen Thompson emerging as a new welterweight title contender with this win, so I want you to check that out, and some other stuff. Oh yeah, I recently interviewed Jeff Jarrett, so if you have time, check out, you know, the columns in the Wrestling Zone. Check out my interview with Jeff Jarrett, it was very interesting, so yeah, check that out too.
Alright, thanks Jeff, I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Alright, as for me, again, I'll be back in 2 weeks to provide live coverage of UFC Fight Night 83. Given that there's nothing, you know, next week, I might get around to writing something. And something Thompson did, you know, just kind of struck a bit of a, you know, intellectual nerve that I kind of want to talk about. Not in a bad way, but again, movement being incorporated into MMA finally. I'm not promising, but I mentioned a few times that I might write. But now that I don't have anything to preview or, you know, worry about covering, better than average chance. All right, so be on the lookout for that. We'll be back next week previewing UFC Fight Night 3, and it's all 14 fights. Ugh, just too many. Too many, guys. Come on. All right, until then, till next time, we'll be back at our same time next week, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until then, thank you all for being here again. Thank you for sharing the show via whatever method you do. You can follow the Radulich and Broadcasting Network on Facebook. That's the best way to get consistent updates. Continue to do that. Thank you all so very much for being here. Until next time, I'm Robert Winfrey for Jeff Harris, reminding everyone out there to continue to be well, be safe, and behave.